Hi, I'm Jefferson Fernandez, neurologist, and this is the first of a series of podcasts in digital health from a partnership between Telehealth and Medicine Today and the International Society of Telemedicine in Health. I am Director of Education of the International Society and Editor for Latin of the THMT. Joining me are three distinguished professionals in the field of digital health to discuss today's topic: artificial intelligence in telemedicine. So we have here Sarah Harper, who leads AI analytics and automation initiatives at Mayo Clinic and holds the academic rank of Assistant Professor of Healthcare Administration. Sarah also serves as an advisor to Mayo Clinic platform, supporting solution developers and health systems in tech implementation and evaluation. We also have Sarah Bell, who is a nurse leader in digital health innovator with 20 years of nursing experience. She led virtual care programs at Mayo Clinic and now serves as a chief clinical officer at Outcomes AI. And also we have Waqas Ahmed, who is a nephrologist, founder and CEO of American Telephysicians, and also of NeuroX. So I'll start by asking each one of you your view on the topic of AI and telemedicine. Please, we can start with Sarah Harper.
Thanks so much for that kind introduction, Jefferson. It's great to be here with you all today. Sarah and Waqas, it's wonderful to be with you on this conversation. I think regardless of the use case for artificial intelligence, excuse me, in medicine or telemedicine, we need to be thinking about how we ensure not just safety and ethics, but also value. So there's a plethora of opportunities. We could talk for an entire season about all the use cases for AI and telemedicine, but I would really just urge our listenership to think about whatever your use case, whatever problem you're trying to solve, how are you going to measure value and assess risk upfront, like any other business opportunity. And really, I found it's surprisingly infrequent that we do that when we deploy AI into virtual care settings or brick and mortar care settings in healthcare. So I'll share just a brief framework that we use. This will likely sound pretty familiar to Sarah Bell. She and I used to work together, fun fact. But we've iterated on it like any framework. We get better every time we apply it. And I'll actually just lead with a quote by Steve Jobs. Hopefully, every listener on this podcast is familiar with the founder of Apple. Steve Jobs said, "Innovation is saying no to 1,000 things." Right, so there's no shortage of opportunity for transformation in healthcare right now, and AI is one tool to apply to that. And we need to have frameworks in place to be able to understand where we can put our limited resources, because the opportunity cost is really high, especially in this field, if we spend money on too many things or on low value things. So the way that we think about value in Mayo Clinic Health System in terms of AI analytics and automation, as we have, if you can picture in your mind a Venn diagram, in each circle, there's one word: desirability, feasibility, and viability. And for those of you that read the business literature, that won't be a foreign framework to you. I was actually originally coined by Kimberly Orton on Medium, but desirability means, is there a strategic need? Do we have a problem to solve? Are we all rowing in the right direction? Feasibility is this technically feasible for our organization to execute? Do we have the resources and capabilities to do it? And then viability is, do we have the operations long term to support it? And that is the one that frequently gets forgotten in the value assessment when we talk about AI and telemedicine. Who's going to be watching baby after they go off to school, right? The fun part is building the solution, even testing it out, and deploying it. And then once you cross the finish line, very few people have thought about ongoing monitoring of that solution for quality assurance, Very few have thought about long-term scalable workflows across various care settings. So I would just encourage the listeners to think about within that Venn diagram, there's a sweet spot where everything overlaps. You have desirability, feasibility, viability. That's where you should be going after those opportunities. And my team has kind of iterated on this model that Kimberly Orton originally coined and added a sub circle within viability to help us identify which solutions are truly scalable over time. So I will stop there. Happy to take questions and looking forward to the discussion from Sarah and Waukas as well.
Thank you very much, Sarah Harper. Lessons learned. Now we go to Sarah Bell. Please, Sarah, your initial views on AI in telemedicine.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Happy to be here. So I think what Sarah Harper said is a very tried and true framework, where and that's kind of how we go about most things in medicine and academic medicine is the a very tried and true approach where you stepwise out implementation in that manner. And having done telemedicine for like over a decade of my career, I can say that telemedicine was built on trying to create efficiencies to the bedside care teams. And it's worked, I think, for the most part. Where it's failed has been in a couple of ways. One, what telemedicine has kind of turned into is taking the undesirable portions of a workflow of somebody who's physically in the person and sending it off to the virtual care team to do. And a lot of times we miss the opportunity to totally redo the workflow. We just kind of hand off portions of it to a remote care team, and we've not done maybe more efficiency gains as we've done. And so I think taking on some of the learnings of virtual care and how we've gotten here, where I think virtual care has kind of peaked, for a sense. COVID really pushed us, and we're kind of, top of the ceiling, right? And we're there for a number of reasons. One, we don't have a workforce. So a lot of healthcare organizations today are saying, well, geez, I have physical patients and I need physical staff. I like virtual care, but it's not necessarily in all aspects going to help me see more patients. Virtual visits might be one thing for providers, but when you get into like virtual nursing, hospital at home programs, other things, it's not really helping them and, net more patient visits or more things. So I think taking AI is going to actually transform telemedicine exponentially if we let it. And I think that exponential gain can only happen if we take a different approach. And so we've always taken a safe approach, and how do we, study something and things like that. But AI is so unique in that it changes day to day, month to month. It's always learning. And so if we take a steady approach, I think if we, I would ask the listeners to maybe put aside your desire for a lot of, guardrails and a lot of, now safety is one guardrail we can't do, but how do you implement and implement quickly, knowing that the models keep changing month over month over month, getting exponentially better. So if we're going to study something, this is going to impact our study results and what we do as impact results. So we can't be so, I think, rigid with the development of AI and the deployment of AI is one. Two is, and this is to my nursing workforce statistics. Becker's posted an article, and it was data from the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, and 40% of nurses are considering leaving the profession by 2029. And if that doesn't scare you, I'm not sure what else can, because that's a lot of nurses that we already don't have. Reasons are not just retirement. We know baby boomers are retiring, but it's this increased burnout and stress. And virtual care is a desirable area for nurses and care teams to work. It gives them some reprieve from the in-person thing. And so now when we're faced with virtual care programs that might not expand, or hospitals saying, well, I need people, I need nurses on the ground, I can't do a lot of virtual care. I think AI will not just transform virtual care and make it a little more efficient, actually exponentially more efficient. It'll also do the same at the bedside and allow for that desire, that fatigue, that burnout, the overload of that's going on for care teams right now, of they're trying to find information. They're trying to take care of patients. Patients are sicker. People are coming out of school less prepared. I think AI will just completely flip that on its head if we let it. If we don't get in the way of ourselves, and this is a, very forward viewpoint, but let's not get in the way of ourselves. Let's allow AI to come out and to see the benefit, definitely within safety guardrails, but kind of let it loose a little bit. Let's see what it can do. Pick a couple workflows, get the ROI. So that's my kind of hot take for the first question, Jefferson.
Okay, thank you very much, Sarabel. Walk us, please, your views on AI in telemedicine.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff and Sarah, Sarabel and Tony. It's a great pleasure and an honor to be invited. Thank you so much. So, as my introduction, Jeff, you mentioned. So I'm the founder and CEO of the company American Telephysician, which is a physician-led virtual healthcare company. NeuroX is our venture focused on the brain health. We are focused on the specialty care, so neuros and the brain health. As a general, I would say in AI, obviously, we see AI as the same principle we see the virtual healthcare, which is essentially it's building a digital healthcare ecosystem to deliver patients care at their doorstep. So if you see this principle, it means how to create ecosystem. The center of this ecosystem is the patient and physician interaction. When it talks about specialty care, there are a lot of things which you physician would need for patient's care, like diagnostics, labs, radiology. You also need to have monitoring, the care plan. And on the patient side, there are, especially in telemedicine, when they are remotely, it also involves the family engagement and how they can essentially get all of these, parts of the care at their doorstep. They may not be, those care resources may not be available near them. So the first principle is to have a data integration, because that is, I think, where one of the big area, a gap is, that we move from, unfortunately, from a paper mess to digital mess. Number two is, before even online consultation happens, you have the screening tools. Take example for the brain health. So a screening tool for dementia, mental health, or the stroke. The third is an easy consultation, which is probably relatively an easier part, along with engagement with the family members. The fourth is the AI, health assistance in actually continuous monitoring and their care plan for the use of wearables, how their sleep is doing, how is their mood, how is their blood pressure. So of course, as we are seeing utilization of all of these wearable and devices, you can see it's increasing. Ton of data is coming in the system. And this is where AI is also helping not only the patients to give them alerts when they need to see a doctor and who they need to see, but also helping physician and clinical care team when to actually have intervention. And last but not least, essentially the AI role in then optimizing all the outcomes. And this is where the payers, the healthcare systems, and other players come in. So at the end, in the summary, I think there is a certainly not only a horizontal role for AI in streamlining all of these steps, but there's also a vertical role in making patient care more affordable and accessible.
Okay, wonderful. So thank you very much for your first introductions. I'll start to ask you some questions, but please feel free to comment the other speak question or answer if you like. Let's make it like an informal conversation. Sarah Harper, as we have two Sarahs here, I have to call you also by your surname. So let's start with you, Sarah Harper. So
Sounds good.
you mentioned that three things that were kept in my mind is desirability, feasibility, and viability. So regarding measurement, how do you decide what metrics to prioritize in evaluating solutions?
That's a great question. Thank you. I would say First and foremost, this has to be start at the beginning. So when the problem's identified and when we're just thinking about what the right fit solution may be in the clinical practice, that's when we're starting to think about how we would measure success, right? So we've defined the problem. How are we going to know when we solved it? It's really that simple. But it's easier for me because it's part of my bread and butter role within Mayo Clinic Health System to think about measuring value and assessing risk upfront. So I'll usually partner with the clinical team that's requested an AI solution. And kind of walk them through the process of defining their objectives and their key results. I try to encourage them to think outside the box. So having like a clinical problem that they want to solve and a business problem they want to solve, and then an equity problem that they want to solve. That last one is one that we frequently forget unless it's our primary goal. But I encourage everybody to think about different types of problems that could be solved through these solutions. Oftentimes, you have a solution that'll solve more than one problem for you. So clearly defining what that problem is, and then what success looks like. The next thing that we really need to make sure we're talking about is what is the baseline value, right? So let's say my solution is intended to save nurses time. Well, how do I know how much time nurses are spending on this task to begin with, right? Oftentimes, we may have that data accessible in a medical record, or we may not. And so we do something really simple. We go out into the practice with a stopwatch and we observe five nurses complete six workflows each, and we've just collected 30 observations using a stopwatch. We know baseline how much their standard workflow is taking them, how much time is taking them. We may even ask them a few questions about their workflow to assess their overall satisfaction. Or we could administer a single item self-measured burnout screener at the baseline value just to see, okay, in general, how are you feeling with this current workflow day to day? And then after that solution has been implemented, which is usually months later, for those of you that work in the field, you know that this doesn't happen overnight, right? To Sarah's point, Sarah Bell's point, I agree with her. I think we need to be a little bit more bold, a little bit less timid when it comes to transformation in healthcare, especially through AI, and take calculated risks, right? And not try to be so methodical with our deployment. That being said, solution goes live. We know what the baseline value was. Now it's time to start measuring the impact, right? And in some situations, that might be going back out into the practice if we're measuring time with a stopwatch and doing the exact same thing again. But we also might think about standard quality metrics like ED visits, reduced length of stay, primary care visits, like completion rate, right? So did they actually show up for their visit? Did they late cancel or not? What were their clinical outcomes? It really just depends on the overall use case. But whenever possible, we're looking at from a clinical perspective, from a patient-centered perspective, and from a staff-centered perspective, are we making a difference? In my role, if we can move the needle on the clinical side of things or on the staff experience side of things, we are absolutely making a financial impact. There's no question.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And Sarah Bell, AI is transforming day-to-day work and could be the idea is to less burden and workload. And how is it working for, how is it's this work regarding virtual nurses and care teams to deliver remote care?
Yeah, so I think we're in the beginning, right? AI is in its infancy in healthcare. So I think in the virtual care space, AI can help in a number of ways. In virtual care, we have to be really efficient because we're taking, we need to be able to care for many patients with few people. We can't have in unfavorable nurse-patient ratios. We have to push them so that they're efficient. And so where AI can come into play in the virtual care setting is in a couple of ways. One is in patient chart summarization. When a virtual nurse is monitoring 50, 100 of patients, that's a lot of data that they potentially have to understand and digest on each patient before they have an interaction with them, before they, as they're answering alerts and alarms. And so AI and its power to summarize the chart, and being able to query information and have it pull right up is fantastic. So that's one huge time saver. The second is in the ability to bring together the disparate systems in healthcare today. So care teams aren't just in the EHR. They're also in some type of telemedicine platform, likely. They're also in another platform that might house protocols, procedures, or guidelines that they have to follow for patients. And a human putting all of those pieces together, it takes time. And so AI can be a connector of systems in an efficient way for the care team, again, providing exponential time savings. And then I think the last piece, which is very interesting to me, and I think is going to create a lot of ROI, is in what we're calling AI patient navigators, but it's the voice agents. And so imagine you have a post-acute RPM program, and we have, people calling to check in on patients. They didn't check their blood pressure 3 days in a row, or they didn't answer their symptom assessment, and so a nurse has to call them and ask them 10 questions, and everything's normal, and then they move on. Those are tasks that can be, done by a voice agent that can be programmed to call the patient and have an interaction. The customer service industry has been using them for a while now, and actually, I think initially people are saying, well, patients, they want to talk to a person. And we used to say the same thing in virtual care. In the beginning of virtual care, the pushback was always the patients want a person in their room with them. They don't want somebody on a screen. And what we found was that the patient actually wants the care that they need in the moment in an efficient way because they want to be able to move on with their day. So the same will be said for a voice agent. If a voice agent can call a patient, can have the interaction in an efficient way, and the patient gets what they need, the care team gets what they need, and everybody can move on with their day, I think when deployed correctly, that's going to be an exponential time saver. Because today, the nurse or the assistants that are calling these patients, they don't have anybody to delegate to. You can't tell somebody else to call the patient, and so your staffing is based on that capacity right there. Is how many patients can somebody call? Well, and a voice agent can call hundreds of patients at one time and get all that information back to the care team. In a note type way. And then the people are then following up with the patients who need them, who have screened positive, and the patients who didn't are moving on with their day. And the care team understands where they're at in their care, and it's a win-win for everybody. So I think that's where in virtual care, that's the big key time savers where AI is going to make exponential impact.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sarah Bell. There's a lot of ch challenges for physicians using digital health. When they use a virtual platform, they have to learn how to communicate, how to bring trust between the relationship with patients. But there is something that is adding to this challenge, which is AI. What is your views or opinion regarding the relationship between the physicians and the patient with all this information that patients now get? AI is empowering patients, and then it's bringing more challenge. So we have the challenge of doing a good or excellent virtual consultation, but then the patient comes with all that information from an AI solutions. What is the impact and how physicians are dealing with this impact in your view?
Well, thanks, Web. I think you hit on the nail. I mean, of course, there are a lot of benefits what AI is solving, health equity, as Sarah Bell mentioned, about summarizing the chart and so on. I think the reality is that the digital transformation in healthcare has always been slower than many of the other industries. And in the past, we have tackled this challenge by kind of telling the patients maybe they'll there's so much information of their fake information or not true information available, and every person is different and so on. So we always have been, which is kind of partly true also, but we also have been because they were previously used to search on Google and come with all these different articles, and which obviously this was no way Now what they do is utilizing the ChatGPT or this OpenAI, they just simply put this on there, it summarizes this. It's hard to kind of, it's becoming harder and harder to deny some of the evidence base because, I mean, I would say it's pretty close to, being correct there. So the only option for the healthcare industry and the provider is to be essentially adopt this trend and also be, up to date on some of these technology. And, and when they're dealing with these patients, they need to obviously have to, it's obviously help them also before seeing the patient. Getting a summarizing and what's in the what's in the market for a lot of new agents or studies coming in there. Now the second part is how to your question, how to kind of communicate with the patients. It is still kind of we are at that intersection. There's a still trust in the real person. Where the AI is at the early stage, but I think that gap is going to be. Probably it will be on the other way around because more and more people, especially with this now, more of the AI-built virtual agent. I'm not just talking about the video audio call, but talking to here's what my labs are, and now AI essentially an avatar telling you this is exactly needs to be done next. The physician's role is likely going to be more and on the administrative side. I must say with this, at least because. Is you still would need some physician to write the order, and 90% of the work will essentially be the same, which what I'm thinking as a physician, what AI telling the patient already, hey, these are the tests needs to be done, and so on, and interpretation. I think as a overall, the quality of healthcare is going to improve significantly because the chances of missing a diagnosing or misinterpretations are going to be less. I'll give you a classic example. I see patient in the senior care facilities. It's not like in health, like hospital where everything is an Epic or so. There's, especially in outpatient, different information is different places, some in paper chart, some in EHR. Now, how to summarize all of this, when you are making a case or making a recommendation, it also depends on your ability to review all of this. And there's high chances that information is missed. But with the AI, essentially, now, first thing is digitization of those records and integration. And then with AI, here's a summary. Here's needs to be done. I think it's making life for the physician easier as well.
Okay, thank you very much. I have another question for you, Sarah Harper. What advice would you have, do you have for health systems struggling to move from pilot project to scale it and measurable impact?
I'm going to repeat the question back to you, Jefferson, just to make sure I heard it correctly. What advice would I have for health systems that are looking to scale transformation?
Yeah,
Thank
that's
you.
it.
I would say don't underestimate the resource that it will take to scale on the human side. I'm not talking about the nurse that AI is going to become a companion on that care team. I'm talking about on the technical side of your business, your AI, your data engineering team, and your expertise when it comes to like post-deployment analytics. And all the maintenance that it takes on the technical back end to ensure a high quality AI organization. I think folks typically underestimate the number of team members and the diverse sets of expertise that are required to successfully deploy and monitor and de-implement certain technical solutions over time. So upfront, you certainly have your clinicians and you have your patients. That's where you're identifying, your customers are identifying their pain points. And ideally, in your product organization, they're helping you co-design solutions. But then you also need your engineers that can build the solutions and validate them and help you get them deployed to certain workflows. You need implementation scientists. They don't have to be PhD implementation scientists. Sarah Bell knows this, that we used to work together on the same team. We had a whole implementation coordination team whose entire job was to make sure that a product was moving through the pipeline successfully and that people were asking the right questions about workflow and operational capacity and then measuring impact post-deployment. You need an analyst team that can actually help you get at the data that's required to measure the value, not just at the initial go live, but over time. And then from a post go live standpoint, well, I almost forgot the most important component. You need operational support from your practice. It needs to be on the administrative side of whoever you're working with in your health system, not the clinicians, but whoever's running the business of the healthcare, needs to be a key stakeholder within the team. And the most important thing is to make sure that they are at the process and that they know where to go, not just with technical questions, but in terms of measuring the impact of the solution, so that they don't always have to be pinging your team for, hey, where are we at with this, right? Are we still seeing a reduction in hospital length of stay with the solution? Yes or no? They should be able to go and readily access that information themselves because they've helped co-design those dashboard solutions that are going to report out on the outcomes over time. And they really are the ones that are going to say, hey, I'm noticing that this is no longer working as expected, right? Now I know I need to go back to Sarah's team and re-engage, and we either need to take a look at the technical solution and see if it needs to be revised, or maybe we just need to remove it because it's no longer relevant, right? The practice is evolving so quickly, the practice of medicine. Our care delivery models are evolving so quickly. The technology is accelerating at a pace that's almost impossible to keep up with. So we're going to need to get really good at turning things off when they no longer are adding value. So I would just say, think about operationally what it's going to take for your AI organization to exist in that post-deployment world. It's not feasible, it's not scalable for a clinical practice team to own that technical debt over time. Right? That's not a scalable, it's a very fragmented way to run your organization. That AI ML ops has to be centralized and scalable within your health system. And if you're not going to build it yourself, your partner needs to have that kind of setup.
Thank you, Sarah Bell. What does it take to build AI that virtual clinicians trust and actually rely on in telehealth workflows?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I'm going to piggyback on what Sarah Harper said. What does it take? It takes a whole team, and you can easily underestimate the amount of resource it takes to deploy AI in care situations. And I think we can underestimate it for a couple of reasons. One is, there's commercial AI, like everybody, I hope everybody uses like a ChatGPT or something to make their day easier. If you don't, you should be, but that has, I think, given the illusion that it's easy. We shouldn't be using those types of models in healthcare. They're putting more safety guardrails around them, but we in healthcare, we have to be safe. We have to make sure that, patients' data doesn't get compromised. We have to make sure that the AI will always answer your question. And we have to make sure that how it's answering it is accurate and providing the right guidance. I also think we have to make sure it's referenceable. The public models out there have done a really nice job of you can click references and see them. But if you're a good steward of references, you probably notice some of them aren't actually real references or, they're not querying the correct information. And so those are all things that tell us that, we need to build on top of these large public models in a way that's built for healthcare so that we have the proper guardrails because people's lives are on the line and that's really important. And so, as creators of AI, we need those teams, we need those technical team members, we need those engineering team members. And as these models keep evolving so quickly, also to Sarah Harper's point, we have to undeploy things and take things away and put in new things. And that takes a lot of technical resource, so it can't be underestimated. So if you're a health system, you either need to put the infrastructure in place or, as Sarah said, partner with, a vendor or a group that's going to do those things for you because that is just critical and crucial to do it. I think the other piece is we have to co-develop with the people who are boots on the ground who are providing the care to the patients. And this is true in any innovation in healthcare. If it's not providing value to that team, everything lives and dies at adoption. If it doesn't get adopted, good luck. You had the best idea ever, but nobody used it. It doesn't matter. It's dead at that point. So you have to do it with the boots on the ground staff. start with one workflow, the workflow that is bothering them the most, that takes up the most of their time. If you can win over the team that's using it, the next innovations will go smoother. You've built trust, you've built that relationship with them of no, they're building for me. I know, and they'll then you'll get to a point where you're able to deploy and have bigger impact items because you've built that trust over multiple deployments. So I think those are kind of the key pieces. And AI is still, new. And so I think what's also exciting is there's a lot of new jobs to be created for nurses, for clinical care team members to be out there and developing these solutions. I think that's really important. How do we develop solutions for the care team with the care team?
So we are having a wonderful conversation here. Lots of insights and information to reflect. And as we are approaching the end of our podcast, I would like to make a question for each one, for all of you to answer. And this relates to what's being discussed from some time regarding the health systems that we have, not only in the US, but in other countries as well, that some people call it sick care. I know it's something that is more related to the disease, to the care of disease, to acute situations, and not much on the prevention and promotion of health, the continuity of care, which telemedicine, telehealth can really provide, touch points in virtual care that are very important for a hybrid care. And that then comes AI, brings this new revolution and impact. We have then some people call the narrow AI to differentiate from generative AI. And some people are just talking that maybe in 5 to 6 years, we might have the general artificial intelligence, which is something that we have to see, but the promise is good. So regarding the transformation of the sick care to a truly healthcare. How do you think AI and telemedicine can contribute to that? And I would like to start with Waka's place.
Thanks, Jeff. So, it seemed like you were reading my mind because when obviously Sarah and that they were talking about, obviously, which is kind of great things in the US healthcare system, but when it comes to international healthcare system, especially, the developing country, things are totally different. I think I want to use the word digital inequity or inequality because let's not forget for AI to work, you need data. And the problem, one of the big problem in the developing countries, they even do not have any EMR system. Most of them, like they do not have, or they have a, digital infrastructure to have the digitization of data in order to use that. So there's obviously is and in the beginning it will be even further widened. Eventually it will essentially be converged because once they have digital transformation in the international, they will already come along with the AI tools. There's a path I could envision for the especially for the developing countries where there's certainly a huge population. There's a lot of new data will coming. I think it's important to also understand how this transformation happened. Is it going to be specific or maybe big corporation specific LLM or even open AI? I think it's going to be more on open AI. This is like where having those integration with open AI model into their system and as well as because there's no way they can afford to have access to more premium LLM model. At least at the beginning, or maybe for screening purposes and so on there will be a big trend for people's own wellness. A lot of time this is where, with the help of this free open source ChatGPT and so on, or the patient education side, a lot of this healthcare will be driven by the patients and their family members, caregivers. And once they have this, a lot of information, then on the physician and healthcare system side, they will essentially have no choice except to implement those at least a free AI model as well as the free EHR systems to serve the population. So this got to be kind of will be an interesting time. A lot of this initiative, I must say, is also has to come on the government side, like how CMS in the US, made this EHR implementation in the hospital a mandatory, and they're driving this across the post-acute care. And I see the same, the cycle likely going to happen in the international markets.
Okay, wonderful. Sarah, if you could give us your views on how though this AI and telemedicine could help changing the sick care to healthcare, critical points that you think would be interesting to tell our audience.
I'm assuming, Jefferson, you'd like me to go first, Sarah Harper?
I'm gonna let you go first, Sarah
Okay,
Harper.
sounds good, Sarah Bell. I would say, I think it's kind of a misleading question. It's not that AI doesn't have potential to transform the system. It certainly does. It has incredibly disruptive, transformative potential. That's why we're all here talking about it. That being said, I think at least from a US healthcare perspective, we're not going to have a healthcare delivery system with a focus on health versus, treating the sick until we have a different business model, a different payment structure. So I think that has to change. But in terms of how AI can make a difference in promoting health and well-being versus treating the sick in the meantime, I think it's the democratization of data and knowledge. I work at the number one hospital in the world. I have arguably access to the best possible care for myself and my children right here in rural southeastern Minnesota. It's pretty incredible. But my care team still has about 1,000 in-basket messages to respond to on a daily basis. They don't have time to take a question about my 7-year-old's symptoms and blood test results, right? So I asked ChatGPT. I put his lab results into ChatGPT and I asked for, what does this all mean? What questions should I be asking my doctor? Am I overreacting if I want a hematology consult? All those types of questions. And not only do they answer my questions, the model 4.0 mini asks if I want a draft MyChart message to send to my child's primary care physician. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible what it can do. And I don't even need to suggest ask for that, right? It's just offering that logical next step in the flow for me as a concerned caregiver. So I think it's going to really amplify patient voice, patient empowerment, for those patients that are engaged with the system, that are motivated. Obviously, that there's a whole different ball of wax for patients that are disengaged, that don't have access to those tools or that knowledge. But that's where I think it's really going to move the needle in the health and wellness space initially, is patient empowerment.
Okay, thank you very much,
Yeah.
Sarah Bell. Your comments?
I'm going to piggyback on that because that's where I was going with it as well, Sarah, is one, yes, I think. Well, I know, I mean, we could have a whole podcast about the EHRs and the commoditization of like healthcare data and all that and just that equity from from countries outside of the US. It's just a massive problem, right? I do think AI will help all the models out there, being able to ingest paper records, scanning them in and reading, so to speak, reading all these documents that a human can't read and summarization. I think that'll help a lot. But what I think about where AI is going to help take us from sick care to healthcare is in that it's in the empowerment of patients and the empowerment of their family members. We did a podcast on telehealth and medicine today with Susanna Fox last year, and she wrote Rebel Healthcare, and it's about patients and their journey to advocating for their health and through peer groups and through reaching out and just being that constant push for finding answers for yourself. Well, now with ChatGPT and other models out there, people are getting diagnosed with AI and it's assisting them to find the right healthcare and to do that. So I think where now the patient can own their healthcare in a way that they couldn't before because they have the tools. They don't have to have a degree. They still need to meet with a physician and have those conversations, but now they can have more informed conversations. And I think that is going to be powerful for any patient who honestly is struggling with to find a diagnosis or is having issues with their health, and it'll help health literacy tremendously. You can ask any AI model to put something into them and say, "Explain this to me like I'm a 10-year-old," right? So taking that information, that material, and getting it down to a level that you can understand. And I think for healthcare to do well, we need patients, to evolve more. We need patients to own their healthcare and own their health and to ask those questions, because there's just not enough healthcare. I think most people who are trying to see a physician today or get seen, you're months back. You just can't see and get help or answers that you need in a timely way. So empowering the patients, I think, is the only way to go, and that's where AI is going to take us into the healthcare future.
Okay, thank you very much. You are living in challenging times. You need to know not only what not only from the perspective of patients, but from health professionals, administrators, those who take decisions, policies from different levels. So it's a time that we should really reflect on what to do and how to do it. This is going to be something very, very important for us. So I'd like to thank you, all of you, Sarah Harper, Sarah Bell, Waqas Ahmed, for being here today, sharing your views, sharing your knowledge and experience. I think we had a very important and very nice podcast. And for those who are watching us, I would like to invite for you to the next podcast. As I mentioned in the beginning, this is going to be a series of podcasts in a partnership of Telehealth and Medicine Today and the International Society for Telemedicine and Health. And thank you very much for watching us. All the best.
Thank you so
Thank
much,
you.
Jonathan.
Thank
Thank you
you.
all. Thank you, Tori. Bye.